Welcome to the Making Sense Podcast. This is Sam Harris. Well, today's guest needs no introduction. Often one says that and then just gives the introduction anyway, but no, Richard Dawkins actually needs no introduction on this podcast, except to say that he has a new book, which is titled The Genetic Book of the Dead, which we speak about in the first part of the podcast, where we talk about the genome as a kind of palimpsest, what scientists of the future may be able to do with our genetic information, genotypes and phenotypes, embryology and epigenetics, why the Lamarckian theory of acquired characteristics just couldn't be true, how environmental selection pressure actually works, why evolution is so hard to think about, human dependence on material culture, the future of genetic enhancement of human beings, viral DNA, symbiotic bacteria, AI and the future of intellectual life, the prospect of resurrecting extinct species. And then we pivot to politics. We talk about the problem of free speech in the UK, which has reached surprising proportions, as well as the problem of political Islam and anti-Semitism. And then we close with some reflections on our friend Dan Dennett. And now I bring you the one and only Richard Dawkins. I am here with Richard Dawkins. Richard, thanks for joining me again.
Great pleasure, Sam. Thank you.
So you have a new book, which I'm sorry to say I have not read in its entirety because I can only spend so much time reading a PDF that gets sent to me. So
yes,
I do not have the physical book yet, but I have read enough to declare that it is fascinating and that people should go out and buy it. So we'll talk a little bit about it, but there are a few other things I want to talk to you about.
Yes.
But first, how are you and what is your life like these days? I think you and I had lunch about, I don't know, a couple of months ago, but...
Yes, we did.
Are you traveling or what's happening?
Yes, well, I'm doing a tour of North America at the moment, and then it carries on in Britain and Europe. And I've said it's my final tour.
Mm.
And it's partly to promote the book. In fact, I suppose it's mostly to promote the book.
And how long are you on the road for?
5 weeks in North America, and then a couple of weeks in Britain and Europe.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, needless to say, I hope it's not your final tour, but I hope that doesn't say anything about your longevity. But
yeah, I hope so too.
Yeah, my last tour might have been my final tour too. So you never know.
Yes. Yeah.
So, let's touch on the book. The title is
The Genetic Book of the Dead.
The Genetic Book of the Dead, yeah. And it's a reference which you disavow early on, it produces an echo which you disavow
early on. It's an echo to the Egyptian books of the dead.
And the Tibetan, I would point out, there's also
Tibetan.
Books. Yeah.
It's just a kind of poetic allusion, really. It doesn't really discuss those books. There's a kind of vague relevance in that I talk about genes as being immortal in the sense that they go on for generation after generation, whereas bodies are cast aside and die. Mm. And so the genes are a kind of set of instructions to the body as to how to not proceed to the afterlife, as it would be in the Egyptian books of the dead, but how to hand the genes on to the afterlife, which is the next generation and the next and the next and so on.
Right. So if we were going to take the analogy literally, and you also draw an analogy, a similar analogy to a palimpsest, which you might describe what that is. But these are both analogies to books. We'll tell our listeners or remind them not to be too pedantic what a palimpsest is.
Okay. A palimpsest is a piece of writing which is partially or wholly erased so that you can write again on the same medium. So in the days when there wasn't abundant ability of paper, people would reuse the same parchment and they would erase what was already there and then write over it.
Right.
And I had a dear friend, Bill Hamilton, a very distinguished evolutionist, who wrote postcards where he would economize by writing in blue horizontally and then he would turn it to a right angle and write in red, carrying on the message. And you could read it by deciphering the coding red, blue, and which way it was pointing.
You provide an example in the book, which I must say I found difficult to read. I mean, that seemed like a provocation to one's friends to be sending them
yes,
letters
that's
of
right.
that kind.
Actually, I did manage to decipher, I think it's the red, I forget which colour it was. Huh. And it's really rather dramatic. It's something to do with somebody getting his bike rammed or something like that. I didn't really read too much of it. But the point is that the Genetic Book of the Dead is a description in the genes and in the body of an animal of all its ancestral worlds, all the worlds in which its ancestors lived, because natural selection has shaped it, has shaped the genes to survive in those worlds. But of course, since its ancestors lived in so many different worlds, old, very old, slightly old, and so on until relatively recent, and then now, it is a palimpsest of writings from all these different ages where they've been partially erased and then written over and then partially erased and written over again.
Yeah, I want to go over that statement again just because it's beautiful and I don't want people to miss the import of it. So to come at it from the other side, if we could read the Genetic Book of the Dead, what would we read there?
In the case of a human or any mammal, we would read old writings about the sea when our ancestors before the Devonian era lived in the sea. Then we would read writings about the emergence onto the land. We would read writings about subsequent history and so on. In the case of primates going up into the trees, some animals went back into the water, which is remarkable, having sort of got all tooled up to come onto the land to then go back into the water. And I've got a subchapter where turtles and tortoises actually came back for the third time. So they came out of the water onto the land, back to the water. So there were land tortoises in the Triassic era, back to the water as sea turtles, where some of them remain, and then back to the land again as modern land tortoises. So that's a doubling back.
And what do you imagine future biologists will be able to do with the genome?
Okay, I have a sort of recurrent fantasy about a zoologist of the future, scientist of the future. I make her female and I call her Sof, as scientist of the future. And I believe that scientist of the future will be able to read the book, which is the animal and its genes, and piece together the entire palimpsest of its ancestral history. It's something we can't do at the moment. And the part of the book is, parts of the book are about the little preliminary fumbling steps, nursery slopes steps, which we can make towards that end.
Given an unspecified genome, how close are we to being able to predict the phenotype of the animal?
Not very close. And that, of course, would be a big problem for the Genetic Book of the Dead. And much of the book actually is not about genes at all. It's about using the phenotype of an animal to reconstruct the book, which is its set of ancestral histories. Sof, in the future, will be able to do it with the genes. And we can't really do that now. There is no decoding process whereby you can get a genotype and say what the ancestral worlds of this animal were.
I think, Richard, we should probably remind people of just, we should define our terms here. What's the difference between a genotype and a phenotype?
Well, a genotype is the set of genes in the animal, and the phenotype is what the genes manifest themselves as. So the phenotype is the body, its behavior, everything that we actually see of the animal.
So what I asked you, given the genome, the series of base pairs, the code that's in the nucleus of almost every cell in an animal's body, could we predict what that animal would look like?
No.
Are we close at all to your knowledge? I mean, this
not
is like
really. No. What you can do is to say exactly what proteins would be programmed by that animal's genome. But the problem then is that the animal itself is produced by the processes of embryonic development, which are masterminded by genes via the proteins. But the actual process itself is such that unless you know a lot about the animal already, you can't really tell. If you're given a wholly new animal that's been found in the seas, a whole new genome that's been found, and you have no idea what kind of animal it is, then you couldn't reconstruct it. But if you could say, this evidently is a species of kangaroo because it looks like the existing kangaroos. Then you're away, and then you can do something with it. But if you know nothing about it, the only way to really find out what that animal would develop as would be to put the genome into a, well, into a female of the animal of the species concerned and let it develop.
Yeah, you actually have a very seditious sentence at some point early in the book, which I think you say it's something like, forgive me for putting dangerous words into your mouth.
Yes, but I know the one you mean.
But they were dangerous on the page. You said something like the best machine for translating a genotype into a phenotype that we know of is a woman or something like that.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I could have said any female.
Yes, right. Yeah. Well, perhaps we'll return to that combustible topic.
Yes.
So what is meant by the word epigenetics and where does that concept come into play here?
Epigenetics is, I think, a much misused word. It's really just a word for embryology. The thing is that every cell in your body, every cell in our bodies, has the same genome, the same diploid set of genes, and yet the cells are all different. So liver cells are different from kidney cells, different from muscle cells, and so on. And the reason is epigenetics. The reason is that some genes are turned on in liver cells, and different genes are turned on in kidney cells, different genes are turned on in nerve cells, and so on. That's epigenetics. Now, there has very recently been a suggestion that some of these turnings on of genes can get passed on to the next generation.
Hmm.
And this has been shown for a few cases. And the word epigenetics has come to be dubbed onto that process of passing on to the next generation. And that's unfortunate because it's become a kind of vogue word of great popularity, suggesting a kind of major revolution. Some people have even thought that it looks like Lamarckian inheritance of acquired characteristics, which it really isn't.
Well, let's just circle on that concept for a second again, just to capture everybody's understanding. What was the Lamarckian thesis, and to what degree does the heritability of some epigenetic settings cash out that thesis?
Okay. Lamarck lived before Darwin, and he had the only other theory for how evolution could work. And it was a bit mystical. He had this idea that animals kind of strive to change their way of life, and they
stretch the giraffe by striving to reach higher and higher leaves.
That's right. Yeah. It stretches its neck.
Yeah.
And then he had two main principles, the principle of use and disuse. The more you use a bit of your body, the bigger it gets. So the more you use certain muscles, the bigger they get. That's why you go into training. And as the giraffe stretches its neck, everything about the neck stretches. So that's the principle of use and disuse. Then he had the principle of inheritance of acquired characteristics. An animal inherits from its parents those changes which occur during the parent's own lifetime. So the giraffe's babies inherit a slightly longer neck because the parents stretch their necks.
Right.
If you exercise your muscles with weightlifting, then your children are born with slightly bigger muscles. That would be the principle of inheritance of acquired characteristics plus use and disuse. And it's all false. It doesn't happen. Use and disuse happens, but acquired characteristics are not inherited.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the modern vogue for what they call epigenetics, where certain genes get turned on, which they do during embryology, those genes that get turned on, if that turning on gets passed on to the next generation, then that is a kind of inheritance of an acquired characteristic, but it's very different from the giraffe's neck. It doesn't have the same adaptive potential. It doesn't have the potential to pass on to the next generation the improved capacity to survive, which the principle of use and disuse would. That's one reason why it's not Lamarckian. Another reason is that it doesn't go on to subsequent generations. It works only for the next generation, not for the indefinite future, which it would have to in order to be evolutionarily relevant.
So let's clarify that point. So let's give an example of what we think actually could be transmitted from generation to generation by way of epigenetics. I mean, forgive me, I'm not close to this literature at all, but I believe I've consumed somewhere the idea that various environmental stresses, let's say the subjection of one population to a near genocide, I mean, some generational trauma meted
starvation,
out to people.
Say.
Right,
yes.
Starvation could do something to the epigenetic settings of the people.
Yeah, it could change the physiology of the children in some way.
Right.
But it would not be. It would not go forward to the grandchildren or the great grandchildren or the great great grandchildren.
Because it doesn't change the germline.
Exactly. It doesn't change the germline. It changes which members of the germline got switched on. But I don't think it's interesting because it's at least not evolutionary. I mean, it's quite interesting from some points of view. It's not evolutionarily interesting because it doesn't go on to the indefinite future. It would have to go on to the indefinite future to be evolutionarily interesting.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, right. I mean, I think it's quite important, quite interesting to think about why the Lamarckian theory doesn't work. I mean, even if it were true that acquired characteristics were inherited, even if the giraffe's neck was inherited,
mm-hmm.
it would not be good enough, not be a powerful enough theory to explain almost everything about evolution. If you take something like an eye, where eyes get progressively better at focusing, better, more clarity, more detail, more precision. That doesn't happen by just use and disuse. It doesn't. It's not the case that the more you use an eye,
mm-hmm.
the more acute the vision becomes. On Darwin's principle, Darwin actually used the phrase, "Nature is daily and hourly scrutinizing every detail." That's one of the main themes of the Genetic Book of the Dead, that daily and hourly, any tiny detail inside the animal, buried however deeply within the animal, which improves the animal's chance of surviving, then that survives and that can go on to the next generation and the next and the next and the next.
Actually, perhaps you can discuss an example of that. I know you go through many in the book, but the one that I recall is with camouflage with respect to, you know, lizards and
yes,
moths.
Yes, okay.
And,
yes.
The thing I want you to illustrate is the point you're making about the daily and hourly scrutiny of the environment.
Yes, that's a lovely phrase of Darwin, by the way. The first picture in the book, I think, is this lizard. It lives in the desert. And all over its back, it's got pictures of sand and stones and pebbles. It looks as though it's got a desert painted on its back.
Mm.
And this is camouflage, of course. And there are many other examples, beautiful examples of camouflage, where in every case you can say that the animals... or rather the environment of the ancestors is painted on the animal's back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those are very spectacular examples. But the thesis of the Genetic Book of the Dead is that it's more than just skin deep. Exactly the same attention to detail must pervade every tiny scrap of detail all the way through the animal. It's not just the skin. It's more than skin deep. It goes right through the animal. The daily and hourly scrutinizing produces the picture of a desert on the lizard's back, but it also produces every little tiny mote of detail inside the animal, which assists its survival. Anything that assists survival and passing on of genes is fair game for natural selection. That just doesn't, the principle of use and disuse and inheritance of acquired characteristics can't do that because it doesn't have this sort of power to adjust to every single detail that Darwinism does, because if it assists survival, it gets through to the next generation and therefore into the future.
But to explain how this could be so incremental, I mean, so you have a moth that looks now exactly like the bark of the tree that it is its, you know, habitual
yes.
stopping point. But obviously no moth could have evolved fully in one generation
quite
to look that way.
Yes.
So how is each increment justified and solidified by the attention of the
exactly.
the daily and hourly attention of the yeah. environment?
You have to start from an ancestor which looked hardly anything like the bark of a tree, or think of a stick caterpillar, which is another beautiful example where a modern stick caterpillar looks uncannily like a stick. It's got little leaf bud scars and everything looks like a stick. Well, originally, the ancestor would hardly have looked like a stick at all. It would have just been a sort of vaguely long-shaped thing, which most caterpillars are. So you're asking the question, how did the incremental process proceed step by step by step to go from a very crude ancestral resemblance to a stick right up to a modern extreme perfection of resemblance to a stick? And the answer, I think, is that the final perfecting stages were provided by full frontal vision by a predator in a good light with full attention playing on the object. Whereas the early stages might have been predators who were just sort of might have caught sight of this thing out of the corner of their eye while flashing past, or maybe in a poor light. Well, under those bad, or from a long distance away. So from a long distance away in a poor light and out of the corner of your eye, even a very crude resemblance to a stick will escape the attention, escape the notice of the predator. And that provides the selection pressure to slightly improve the resemblance to a stick.
So just the slightest change in the probability of being of not surviving there is because you know, now you're dealing with just the all those occasions where you were barely in the field of view of the predator. Just that slight modification is enough to encourage that differential success of that
adaptation. Exactly. Yeah. And then the gradient goes steadily upwards because you've got a whole gradient, a whole spectrum of improved seeing conditions. I mean, if the very poor resemblance is good enough to fool a predator at 100 yards away, then at 90 yards away, it's got to be slightly better in order to. And there are going to be predators that are seeing caterpillars at all those distances. And under poor seeing conditions, the selection pressure produces the first stages in the gradient of improvement to the mimicry. And then the last stages are provided by predators that are looking straight at the caterpillar in a good light and are still fooled by it because the resemblance is so perfect.
Yeah, it's really just an amazingly beautiful process to think about in that regard.
Yes.
Why is it so hard to understand this intuitively? I mean, or perhaps another way of asking the question is, what do you think the barriers are for just a widespread intuitive understanding of the reality of evolution?
I suppose partly it's that the time scale involved is so huge and we're not equipped to deal with millions of years, let alone hundreds of millions of years. That's one thing.
Isn't the time scale sometimes surprisingly compressed?
Short. It is indeed. Yeah. That's right. And that's perfectly true. And in the case of the evolution of mimicry, it could be quite fast.
But sort of either present their own impediment, because if it's too short, it just seems like there's not enough time to have accomplished that miracle. And if it's too long, it's very hard to think about.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's no sweet spot. Yeah.
Well, maybe there is a sweet spot. Maybe, but it'll vary in the different
100,000 years, that's the sweet spot. Yeah.
Well, it depends. I mean, it might be for some cases, and it might be a million years in others. But it probably is surprisingly fast. Another thing I think is that people don't realize that a very, very slight advantage is enough to exert evolutionary change. So when you think about can it really matter whether you've got, say, eyebrows? I have no idea why we have eyebrows, but suppose it's to stop sweat trickling into our eyes. I don't think it is, but just imagine that we have that.
I've noticed it does not do a perfect job.
Yes, okay.
That could just be my problem.
Okay. Well, you might say, why does it matter if sweat trickles into your eyes? I mean, does that really affect survival? Well, it might, because you might not see the saber tooth approaching quite so soon if your eyes are all gummed up with sweat.
Especially if there's sunblock mingled in with the sweat.
Especially, yes. And the point is that because we're dealing with genes and the statistical frequencies of genes as they change in frequency over generations, any gene that tends to make eyebrows stop the sweat trickling into your eyes, it's not just the one occasion, it's all those thousands of occasions in different individuals where the same gene has its beneficial effect, not only at the same individuals at the same time, but through different times. So statistically, a gene can have a very small beneficial effect, but that beneficial effect is kind of multiplied up over all the different individuals that it influences over a larger stretch of time where it does its influencing. And because of that, those genes which are good at helping individuals to survive are the ones that we see, the ones that actually come through the generations. And so even a very slight advantage like stopping sweat trickling into your eyes is enough to do the trick. Even though that's counterintuitive, and you ask the question, why is it intuitively so hard to understand? I think that's another reason.
What do you make of the fact that human beings seem so imperfectly selected to survive without material culture, right? I mean, so like, actually, our David Deutsch, who I know you know at least by reputation, if not personally, over there
I
at Oxford.
Him, yes.
You know, very smart man. He's he's made the point that the Earth already is essentially a spaceship for us, right? So, like, if you just leave him out exposed, even to an Oxford night, you know, without the benefit of shelter or clothing or fire, or you know, he's for at least many nights of the year, he's likely to die of hypothermia, right? So it's like we're these naked apes that are not great at survival, apart from being in tribal bands who have produced a modicum of material culture that and an ability to pass on that culture to subsequent generations. But in and of themselves, you know, each representative of the species, devoid of culture, you know, put on a desert island, is liable to die in, you know, over the course of 72 hours or a week because of just being fundamentally unable to survive when slammed up against raw nature. What do you make of the difference between human beings and basically everything else we see in the living world?
I suppose if you were to go back to our time when we lived for such a long time in Africa, in the savannah, we would have been a lot better at surviving as individuals then. Even then, we would have needed culture, but nothing like so much as we do today. I mean, now we have supermarkets. We get our food prepared for us. We don't have to go and get it. We don't have to go and find it or hunt it or kill it or gather it. We just go into a shop and buy it. And we are mollycoddled by electricity and central heating and all that kind of thing. If you were to take not a modern American and or Englishman and put him out on the expose him to the elements, you might die. But if you were to do the same with a Kung San from the Kalahari Desert, they're a lot better at surviving.
Yeah.
Or an
Australian
Aboriginal.
At least in the Kalahari Desert, yeah.
Yes, or yeah. Australian, a native Australian in the Australian outback, they do pretty well. And I think we've co-evolved culturally and genetically. And when we've gradually emancipated ourselves, I mean, our genes have gradually moved us on into a world in which we, because we are surrounded by culture, and culture has been gradually evolving at the same time, well, much faster, then we have become dependent upon the culture which has been evolving at this very rapid rate. Things like wearing clothes, things like taming fire, and going on to central heating, and cooperative living such that we have farmers who grow food for us so we don't have to grow it ourselves, etc. I think it's not that difficult to understand how it's happened, this co-evolution with culture and technology.
What are you expecting us to do with our increasing power to actually engineer changes within our own genomes? If you had a time machine and you could glimpse what we're up to on that front 50 years from now or 100 years from now, what would you expect?
We've been changing the genomes of domestic animals and plants for thousands of years, very radically. And so the sort of domestic animals that we keep, like cattle and horses and pigs, chickens and pets like dogs, are incredibly different from their wild ancestors. And that's been achieved not by manipulation of the genes directly, but by artificial selection. So if you think that a Pekingese and a Chihuahua are actually genetically wolves that have been modified by differential selection by humans, you're now asking the question about the other part of the Darwinian equation, which is mutation. We've shown we can modify animals by selection. We've never done that with humans, and the Nazis tried, and thank goodness they didn't succeed. But I mean, you could have bred. I mean, one could imagine that in thousands of years' time, if totalitarian regimes started selecting humans the way we've selected dogs and cabbages, you could produce all sorts of monstrous humans analogous to producing chihuahuas from wolves. And
yeah, but obviously you can do it much more quickly. Yeah.
Yes, is much quicker, but you don't know what you're doing. Coming back to your earlier question, we don't actually know very much about how to do that. If you wanted to produce you want to produce an animal, take one that hasn't been domesticated, like say a hedgehog. You want to produce a hedgehog which could do the high jump and jump impressively high fences. in principle, you could do it. You could do it by selective breeding. It would take a while, but there's no reason why you shouldn't gradually improve the jumping ability of a hedgehog until it could jump a foot and then 2 feet and so on. Just the way you be bred dogs to change from wolves into Pomeranians and Spaniels. But to go into the genome of a hedgehog and say, let's change the genes to make it into a high jumper, that's in principle possible, but would take a lot more knowledge than we have at present for how to do that.
Right.
The same with humans.
But I would think that if we just keep making progress, we will eventually have the understanding of the relevant genomes and the technology by which to intrude into our own genomes. I mean, we already have CRISPR, and presumably that's only going to get better and better and better understood in terms of the implications of making any change. At a certain point, I mean, we already see an appetite for body modification and general strangeness in among humans, right?
Yes.
We see people who tattoo their entire bodies. We see bodybuilders who develop their musculature to the absolute maximum capacity, you know, with the aid of pharmacology that compromises their physical health, right? And this also happens among athletes. So there's clearly an appetite for extreme performance and extreme aesthetics that, you know, completely divorced from performance of any kind, you know, even degraded performance, you know, that allows for extreme aesthetics. There's an appetite for that. So once we get the ability to, let's say, modify the tendons and ligaments and muscles in such a way as to make a person you know, analogously strong to, you know, to a gorilla or a chimpanzee. Do you have any doubt that people are going to start doing that the moment that technology becomes remotely democratized?
And if you're asking me about whether I have doubt to whether people would take advantage of the opportunity, I don't have any doubt, because people do the most extraordinary things. Yes, I think that they would. I sometimes say, well, we haven't changed humans by selection the way we've changed dogs, so why would we change them by genetic manipulation? But of course, there is an important difference, which is that selection is something that takes many generations, and it could be done by a totalitarian regime.
Now, this is the question of what you could do to yourself as a consenting adult.
But what you could do to
adult.
Yourself is another matter, because that could be much quicker. And yes, I suppose that's true, because bodybuilders already, I mean, if you look at some of the pictures of extreme bodybuilders, they are, well, I was going to say grotesque, perhaps that's not unkind, but it shows what can be done by various sorts of manipulation, and genetic manipulation could be even more powerful than that. So yes, I could imagine that, whether it would just be physical, I mean, maybe you could even produce musical geniuses, make another Mozart or another Bach by this means is a tantalizing thought.
I guess I spend very little time thinking about this, you know, the far future or even the near far future with respect to this, but I spend much more time thinking about the implications of artificial intelligence with respect to this kind of time horizon. But when you think of genetic engineering, it's very hard for me to imagine what would prevent us from going some significant distance down this path, right? I mean, there are concerns about synthetic biology and the engineered pandemics and all of that, and also there are ethical concerns of the sort that you reference with respect to eugenics and, you know, totalitarian control of populations. But when you just imagine the technology becoming more and more available to the individual user, in the way that, you know, by analogy, in the way that drugs, illegal and otherwise, or legal and otherwise, are available to people now. You know, anabolic steroids being the example we're using with respect to bodybuilding. It's very hard to imagine us culturally, you know, perfectly collaborating to avoid extreme outcomes on a global level. I mean, I just don't see how.
Yes, I think you're right.
We avoid it. Yeah.
Yeah, I quite agree.
Okay. Well, is there anything else in the book that you want to draw listeners' attention to in terms of your purpose in writing it, or what was most interesting to you in researching it?
There is a sort of sting in the tail, I suppose, in the last chapter, which you won't have got to yet, where I make the suggestion that we should regard all our own genes, what we call our own genes, as symbiotic viruses. a gigantic colony of symbiotic viruses. And that's not as radical as it sounds. It doesn't mean that a whole lot of independent viruses, sort of like the flu virus and COVID virus and so on, came together in us. It doesn't mean that. It's rather that I make a distinction when looking at parasites or looking at symbionts like viruses or bacteria between those that get to a new victim by passing through the gametes, passing through the sperms and eggs of the present victim. So imagine a bacterium or a virus whose method of getting from human to human is by eggs or sperms. Then if you think about what they want of the body in which they sit, what they want is exactly the same as what the body's own genes want. They want the animal to reproduce. They want it to survive, therefore, in order to reproduce. They want it to be sexually attractive. They want it to be a good parent. They want it to rear its young, because that's their ticket to the future. So every one of our own genes cooperates with the other genes in our own genome. All the genes in our body cooperate to produce a body, because that's their hope for the future. That's the only way they're going to get into the future. And that's what natural selection is all about. Selfish genes are being selected for their capacity to go into the distant future. Now, a virus whose method of getting into the next generation is also via eggs or sperms has the identical interests at heart, so to speak, as your own genes do. And whereas a virus that has a different method of egress from the present body, like being sneezed out and then breathed in by the next one, or coughed out, or coming out as diarrhea and getting into the water supply and getting drunk by the next victim, those viruses or bacteria have not the same interest at heart. They might want the body to stay alive just long enough to get to have the next sneeze, but they're not. If you make a list of all the desiderata, all the things that they want their body to do, it does not include surviving to reproduce. It does not include being sexually attractive. It does not include all the other things I mentioned. Well, it might include being sexually attractive if the parasite gets passed on by, if it's a sexually transmitted disease. That would be a special case, which kind of proves the rule. So if you were to look at all our own genes, they're just like viruses that have the same interest at heart. And that's what I mean when I say that all our own genes can be thought of as a gigantic colony of viruses which cooperate with each other, because they all have the only hope of getting into the future is to pass through the same exit route, the same little vessels, which are the sperms or eggs. And so why make a distinction between viruses which get passed on by that route and our own genes? You might as well call them all viruses or call them all genes. That's the sort of sting in the tail in the book, anyway.
It's a provocative analogy. What is it? Are we aware of any viruses that target the gametes that way?
Oh yes, and I think it's something like 8% of what we think of as our genome really did come in as separate viruses.
So I know about viral DNA in the genome, but what I don't know about are active viruses that target the gametes and successfully passed to future generations through the gametes. What I mean is discernible as viruses that may have some consequences that we might not like, all things considered.
But my point is that we would like them, because they would have been selected over the generations to become more and more benign, exactly the same way as our own genes are.
Yeah, well, I get that, but they would still circulate as viruses in viral bodies. And not be sequestered in our genomes.
Well, no, I don't think they would. I mean, I think they would lose that separate circulation can become sequestered.
But you could imagine some middling stage where it's like it's not enough. There's some differential success that allows this to happen, and yet all things considered,
you should see a middling stage. I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure how you would even detect it. And in the case of bacteria, I suppose mitochondria. I mean, mitochondria are bacteria. They're descended from bacteria, and they are benign because they are, they pass, their only hope of getting into the next generation is to pass through eggs, not sperms, but just eggs in this case.
Right.
And this is a whole genome, not separate genes. This is a ring chromosome. A mitochondrion has a ring chromosome just like a bacterium. It is a bacterium. It's a bacterium that's been living symbiotically for billions of years, and so was only recently even noticed as being a bacterium. But all our mitochondria are bacteria that reproduce autonomously within our cells and then get passed on to the next generation only in eggs, so they only go down the female line.
Right. Yes. Well, was that Lynn Margulis's thesis?
Yes, it was. Yeah. And she deserves great credit for it. Yeah. She wasn't quite the first to think of it. It was actually quite an old idea, but she really revived it and pushed it and is really responsible for the fact that it is now universally accepted.
Mm. How much time do you spend thinking about artificial intelligence these days?
Well, everybody seems to be thinking about it these days, and I
do. Are you using it much? Have you actually?
I have
become a tool of your research.
I've tried a few little experiments. I tried asking ChatGPT I asked it to write an essay on evolution in the style of Donald Trump, for example. It did a brilliant job.
That's very funny.
and in the style of Richard Dawkins, it did a pretty good job of that as well. Mm-hmm. Actually, I wasn't very impressed with its factual knowledge. I happened to ask a question about Helen Spurway, who was a geneticist who lived in the early part of the 20th century and was actually married to J.B.S. Haldane, the great biologist. Mm. And it said, after Haldane died, Helen Spurway married Richard Dawkins.
Yeah.
So I said...
Certainly one hallucination, yeah.
I said, no, she didn't. And it said, oh, sorry, we got that wrong.
I know, I love those exchanges. I've had many of those exchanges
she married Aldous Huxley, which is also wrong, false. So what I don't understand is why it can't just look things up in Google like the rest of us and get it right.
Well, there's some that can now. There's some that do, but nothing is error-free, but how do you imagine we will proceed once it's truly error-free, or as error-free as, orders of magnitude better than a human researcher, right? So perhaps not error-free, but better than a person across the board. What do you think, just pedagogically, what will it mean to be a scholar of the future when anyone can get the answer to any question that a human scholar could produce immediately on their phone?
Well, I'm totally baffled by how it works, and I've been told how it works, but I find it almost incredible the way it's possible for it to instantly produce prose which is indistinguishable to me from what a human could produce already.
Mm.
I mean, I've even asked it to write me computer programs doing things that I needed doing, and it showed great intelligence in sussing out what it was I exactly wanted to know. And it's very hard to believe it isn't. I know it isn't conscious. I even asked it, "Are you conscious?" And it says, "No, I'm not conscious." And now you're saying, what will it mean when?
I'm just thinking culturally, like just imagine your own career. What would have happened to your career had you had the perfect research assistant available to you from the earliest point? And I mean, it just seems, like anyone can produce a brilliantly written essay about evolution by just a single prompt, right? I mean, we're not there yet, but we're there. I will be amazed if we're not there in 5 years at this point.
Yes,
so,
I agree. Yeah.
So what, just pedagogically, I mean, you've spent a fair amount of time associated with universities, and obviously you've lived and breathed in academic environments for much of your life. What will true success, even in this limited form of AI? I mean, we're not talking about super intelligent AI that can do anything. We're just talking about the perfect accessibility of superhuman scholarship to everyone all the time. What does that do to the public intellectual or the academic?
I quite totally share your curiosity about this. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the perfect research assistant. We've already got that,
right?
I think
right.
It would be the perfect professor. I mean, the perfect, and it's course, you know, your question is begged in a way by the assumption that it will be perfect, and it's possible that it won't be. But I share your intuition that it will.
Yeah, I mean, it'll certainly be perfect enough, right? I mean, if not perfect in the limit, it'll be so much better than a normal person. I mean, it already is on so many fronts. But
yes,
just by analogy to a calculator, right? I mean, for arithmetic, you know, it's as good as it ever needs to be. Even if
will it be an Einstein? I mean, will it have the? And I don't see any reason why it shouldn't, because in principle, I mean, Einstein's brain was a mechanism which must be realizable in silico or in some kind of artificial medium, but it might not be very soon. That level of human simulation might not be very soon.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, again, provided we just keep making progress, which, you know, given the economic incentives, that it seems enormously likely that we will. I just think it's, you know, we're talking about the difference between 5 years and 50, but, you know, if 50 is already pretty soon. You know, we've had the iPhone for, 17 years, right? I mean, so like that's 17 years is at the pace of progress now, it seems like an extraordinarily long time. You know, I'd be willing to bet that we have a digital Einstein for physics in 17 years at this pace. I mean, I just don't see the difference between an Einstein and an average graduate student in physics now is really just the historical contingency that Einstein initiated the insights into relativity and other topics, you know, for which he duly gets credit and is celebrated. But I think it's also true to say that every ordinary graduate student in physics now understands more physics than Einstein did, right? So the question is, you know, it's just that initial spark of the new idea. I don't know. I'm not especially precious about that requiring much more neural real estate or information processing in the end, especially when you imagine a system that has access to the totality of what everyone else is doing, right? It's like just being able to integrate, you know, all the data and all the papers and all the arguments and all the connections in a way that no human ever could, and to be doing that in real time, you know, this actually comes back to your, you know, Darwin's description of the environment for evolution, right? Just the fact that it is always paying attention, right? It's always doing the integration of the consequences of each little incremental change. You know, we're now engineering the intellectual equivalent of that adaptive landscape.
But Einstein had this astonishing capacity to depart from common sense. I mean, the idea that time would come to a stop if you traveled at the speed of light. I mean, that sort of thing is so counterintuitive.
Yeah.
It's not just integrating information, it's throwing overboard everything that you think is obvious and fits with common sense.
But then in a lot of the creativity could just be in the prompts we give to these systems, or that we could have them prompt themselves in the end. I mean, we could have the AI talk to itself, or one AI talk to another. But I mean, just to ask it to be counterintuitive and to be non-standard and to reverse various expectations would be a way of perturbing it so as to find new spots on the landscape. I mean, it's by analogy to what happened in that game of Go where, you know, AlphaGo beat the world champion. And I forget what move it is, move 37 or move 33, but there was a move there that every human Go master was convinced was an error. And then, you know,
it proved
to just change every Go master's view of what was possible in the game. And
the question is, should we despair that humans will become, I mean, the life of the intellect will become something that humans are not needed for, and we just could lounge around on couches just sort of eating grapes and letting the machines do all the intellectual work, or maybe become so completely superseded that we just don't exist anymore. And actually, Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal, when talking about the possibility of alien life, of encountering life on other worlds, makes the point that if we ever do encounter it, it's most likely to be not the original life on that planet which evolved there, but the technological form of life, the artificial life, which survived much longer, because it may be that the time span of biological life is rather short compared to the subsequent time span of technological life, of artificial life, which goes on beyond. And so if we ever do encounter aliens, it'll probably be the form of their robotic successors, they themselves having gone extinct.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know whether to be depressed about the thought that we might be superseded by our robotic descendants or not.
Well, would you feel depressed at the thought that biological evolution would just continue and we would be superseded by species that don't look like us?
I would be sad to think that nobody was around to appreciate Shakespeare and Schubert, because there's something about the human legacy which I think is utterly precious. But there's no reason to suppose that they might not be able to, that our artificial creations might not respond emotionally to Shakespeare and Mozart.
Well, I think everything turns on whether these artifacts are in the end conscious, right? If the lights are never switched on, but we're now in the presence of increasingly powerful and competent and intelligent machines, it's hard to escape the dystopian feel of that.
Right. Yes.
But if there's something that it's like to be a super intelligent machine, well, it's also nonetheless a terrifying prospect that our interests might not, in fact, be aligned with the next generation of super intelligent machines, and it may spell the end of humanity. But leaving that aside, it's less depressing to imagine that our digital descendants might supersede us if, in fact, there's something that it's like to be them, and in the end, they are capable of a greater range of happiness and insight and creativity and joy than our species ever was going to be.
Yes. Right? You know? I'm sorry, I won't be around to sort of see the answer to the question because it is fascinating.
What do you think about the, I think we spoke about this the last time we spoke, but I think there has been more progress made in the intervening year or so, the efforts to resurrect the woolly mammoth and a few other species. I think you're as enthusiastic about that as I am, right? You think that should be done.
Yeah. Yes, I would love to see it done. Yeah. I'm just so curious. It would be a wonderful sight for the same reason as I would hate to see the present elephants go extinct.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would hate to see them go extinct, I also would love to see extinct ones brought back.
What would you think about people designing species that are truly novel based on a more complete understanding of the relationship between genotype and phenotype that of the sort that we were discussing earlier?
What are you thinking of there? I didn't quite get that.
Well, so just imagine someone creating effectively a dinosaur that never existed, but nonetheless is impressive to see in a zoo or elsewhere.
Well, that would also be very interesting in a different way. Yes, I mean, yes, I suppose I could imagine you could do that. It would be, in a way, less interesting.
Depending on what you created, it could be almost infinitely interesting and terrifying, but what it lacks is the time machine satisfaction of looking
precisely,
at...
Precisely, yes.
You know, this is a T-Rex.
It would be just like making a sculpture. Yeah. It would be, you could think of it as a work of biological art to make a fictitious dinosaur. But why call it a, why a dinosaur? Why not just some kind of random monster?
Right.
Some very beautiful creature which never existed. That would be a work of biological sculpture. Genetic sculpture. You could produce a super animal that was beautiful in all sorts of ways, but never existed. And that just would be a work of art, I think.
It is interesting. So to pivot recklessly here into politics and controversy,
yes.
Richard, what the hell is happening in your own country around free speech in response to these very ugly far-right riots that we saw recently? I'm hearing rumors of people being arrested for tweets and retweets. And I mean, some were clear provocations of violence, but some really weren't. And I mean, the thing that caught my attention was Our friend Douglas Murray was attacked by Alistair Campbell, who I actually don't know, but I now notice that he's a fellow podcast host with Rory Stewart, who I've had on this podcast and argued with him about the threat of Islamism. But Alistair apparently thought that Douglas should be prosecuted for things he said about Islam, which are identical to things that you and I have said about Islam, just by way of worrying about the consequences of
yes.
failures of assimilation of religious fanatics in the UK. What's happening there?
I deplore the riots themselves, but I also deplore the use of censorship to try to put away people who are saying perfectly reasonable things, as Douglas Murray always does. I mean, incitement to violence is a different matter, and where it actually is a clear incitement to violence, with that's prosecutable. But yes, I think there's a dangerous tendency towards a big brotherism going on now in Britain because of what you've said. Yes, I agree with you.
I mean, there are clear cases where it's unwise and therefore unethical to say various things online because of the possibility of inflaming an already combustible situation. I mean, so somebody like Elon Musk, I think, tweeted in response to this, civil war is inevitable, right? I mean, that's his political opinion or historical opinion, but it's kind of idiotic and reckless to be saying that when you have 200 million people following you on the platform and you're messaging into this conspiracy-addled environment. But the idea that should be illegal
seems crazy, a forecast of the future rather than incitement. He's not saying he was inciting people.
Exactly.
A much less sort of dangerous example. A few months ago, a man in, I think, Newcastle or somewhere in the north of England was visited by the police, not to be arrested, but to be threatened with he was, as it were, they'd taken note and he was on the books as a possible suspect, because he tweeted a joke, and the joke was, what is it that trans people say when you're born assigned? That's right. Mm-hmm. I was assigned mammal at birth, but I identify as fish. Please don't misspecies me.
Mm.
Which is obviously a satirical joke about trans ideology. And that's not incitement to violence. That's satire. That's what satirists have done. That's what Tom Lehrer did. That's what Gilbert and Sullivan did.
Monty Python could have done that.
Python. I mean, you could arrest any of those people.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is a very, very disturbing tendency when you have a sort of puritanical big brotherism attempting to suppress thought, actually. Just utterly different from worrying about incitement to violence. Incitement to violence is another matter. But to arrest somebody for misgendering or even satirizing is a very dangerous and horrible, disgusting, actually, step in the direction of totalitarianism.
Yeah, so it seems that the UK is on a very different footing than the US. I mean, as much as this problem does ail us in terms of, what happens to people's reputations online and even in the real world when they trespass on any of these specific taboos, what you don't have are the police showing up at your door to enforce the exact shape and size of the Overton window. I guess this is all ascribable to the fact that we have a Bill of Rights and a First Amendment, and you don't.
It's often said that we don't have a First Amendment, but still we have a sort of unwritten code of decency, which includes free speech and which is in danger of being trampled upon.
It does. Forgive my naivete as an American. It does make me wonder how you guys have gotten on this long without a First Amendment. I mean, how is it that you don't have a legal apparatus that protects free speech with real clarity? And how is that not just played total havoc with your culture for centuries.
We don't have a constitution at all. We don't have a written constitution. We have a kind of evolved constitution by accretion, which is just a collection of laws and customs and things that have grown up over the centuries. And it's never been properly codified and written down. And I suppose the question you're asking is just an aspect of that.
But like, what are the? I mean, but you have laws, right?
And of course.
And presumably, you don't have laws that infringe upon free speech to a degree that has become dystopian. But something there must be some law that allows or demands, in this case, that the police show up at someone's house for making a joke to the disadvantage of trans activists.
Well, I think it's a rather new trend. There is a custom that free speech is sort of sacred, and it's being violated in the ways that we've discussed. I mean, the police, if that man had been prosecuted, there's not a hope in hell he would have been put in jail. I mean, he would have got off. Hmm. It's just the sinister aspect of it. I mean, he wasn't even arrested. He was cautioned. He was warned.
Right.
And similar cases. I mean, judges have come out very strongly and sort of said what nonsense this is. But there's no written constitution that they can appeal to when they do that.
Hmm. What's your current level of concern around political Islam in the UK? I mean, it feels to me that many people are excruciatingly aware of it, and many people are excruciatingly in denial of it. It became most visible to me recently in response to the horrors of October 7th, nearly a year ago, when you saw the protests, effectively, you know, the pro-Hamas protests, both in America and the UK. But in the UK, they just had a different character. I mean, they were a different scope. You know, they were much larger in a city like London. And also just the police response seemed, in many cases, fairly bonkers. I mean, I think there's one famous case of a Jewish man, you know, essentially being cordoned off and prevented from walking in public because it was just objectively too dangerous to be visibly Jewish in London at this point.
I know, yes, it was horrible.
But like, as though that were a solution to this underlying political problem.
Yes.
How do you view
I agree with you.
England at this moment with respect to this?
Well, I'm shocked by the one-sidedness of it. I mean, the demonstrations against Israel started even before Israel began to retaliate.
Mm-hmm.
So it was that there seems to be a presumption among certain circles in both Britain and America that Hamas must be right because they're Muslim and downtrodden and the underdog, and I'm not quite sure what. And because they're not white, so there's a sort of horrible double standard whereby you get things absurd movements like gays for Palestine, where, you know, it's often been pointed out that gay people wouldn't survive for very long in Palestine because of the Islamic attitude towards homosexuality. I think I think you probably agree, I would ask whether you agree, that there's a strong element of anti-Semitism, anti-Jewishness, which is historically been always there, of course, and seems to be rearing its ugly head again in these demonstrations. I mean, there are other wars going on where you could equally imagine having demonstrations against so-called genocide and things, but it's the particular fact that Jews are involved, I suspect, that motivates some, perhaps many people to join in these demonstrations, whether they know it or not. I think there may be a sort of lurking anti-Semitism going on there.
Mm. Yeah, I certainly believe that's true, although I'm much more focused on the clash between Islamism and jihadism and Western values more generally. I mean, I think anti-Semitism is its own phenomenon and variable, but, you know, like I would expect to see the same, you know, or similar problems, you know, having nothing to do with the topic of Israel and the Palestinians in the Britain of 2024, given some other provocation, whether it's, you know, a cartoon controversy or something else. It just seems like there's there's a tipping point now where there are enough Islamists in the UK that the at least, you know, half of your politics has begun to conform to their demands rather than recognize how unacceptable their demands actually are, right? And so you have people who are just, you know, bending over backwards to deny the reality of the problem, and you have the reputational costs to people who acknowledge the problem, such that only someone as intrepid as Douglas or people to the right of Douglas who have not a care in the world about how they're perceived by the elites or anyone left of center, only those people will feel free to comment on the nature of the problem.
Yes, I enormously admire Douglas Murray's stance on these issues. Yeah. I think he's brave and obviously highly intelligent. So yes, I totally agree.
Well, Richard, it's always fantastic to speak with you. I realize we haven't spoken publicly since our friend Dan Dennett died. Obviously, he's quite missed, you know, personally by his friends and the many people we know who are his colleagues. But he's also missed culturally. I think you said this. We're on a perhaps I shouldn't mention this because we're on some. This is a private email thread. But you and I both got roped into an email thread on questions of consciousness and ontology. And there are many people on this thread who we might say are very far from away from you and Dan with respect to their scientific intuitions.
I know what you mean. Yes, yes. Yeah. Not to say it downright bonkers.
But. Yeah. We won't name names, but you definitely, one of your contributions was just to say how missed Dan Dennett is at moments like this. And I agree, even though, you know, Dan and I did not agree in the philosophy of mind on certain of these questions, you know, about consciousness and free will, et cetera. But there are not that many 800-pound gorillas left.
No.
And it's quite a moment to
I miss him enormously, not just personally, but he was a kind of intellectual elder brother. I'm actually a year older than him, but I think of him as an intellectual elder brother. He was sort of my go-to person. If I was confused about something and thought I was detecting confusion in other people, I would go to Dan and sort of seek him out. And I feel lonely without him, really. Mm. Intellectually lonely. I mean, I don't mean personally, because I didn't, you know, spend all that much time with him, but intellectually lonely in the sense that he was a great, as you say, a big beast in of the intellect, to whom you could appeal to join in debunking nonsense in a powerful, swinging way. So I miss him hugely.
I realized after he died that most of our relationship was virtual. Most of it was by exchanging email. You know, we hadn't spent that much time, you know, physically in each other's presence at conferences and at dinners. I mean, we had done some of that, but, you know, far and away the majority of our communication was in writing by email. And I realized that, you know, all these emails, you know, virtually all of them were still on my computer, and I could just re-experience my relationship with Dan just by reading everything we had written to one another. And so I did that over the course of a day and a half, and I discovered, to my surprise, because I had forgotten a lot of it, that, you know, that I really had relied on him and also you and Steve Pinker as, you know, intellectual mentors, you know, early on in my career as a writer, and, you know, in our various skirmishes publicly, you know, we would write essays or op-eds or letters to the editor or respond to some attack or, you know, plan some debate. And there was a lot of back and forth by email. And I just was just amazed at how lucky I was to have Dan and yourself and Steve and a few others to, I mean, you all have been so generous with your time. I was, again, I knew that in the abstract, but going back and reading a lot of these threads that, you know, some you're on, some are, had many exchanges just with Dan. And it's just, I really marvel at the generosity shown to me by Dan and yourself and Steve with your time. And I guess now I'm just taking the opportunity to thank you, because I don't think I ever had the opportunity to thank Dan explicitly on that point. It's just, I was just wonderfully lucky to have had you guys in my corner early on as I started making noise in writing, especially. And it was, I shudder. I mean, not to say I didn't make mistakes, but I shudder to think of the mistakes I would have made to not have had that early influence from you guys.
That's very moving what you say, Sam. And I feel the same way about Dan. I mean, as a mentor, that's exactly what I think of. And I agree with you. I mean, I think the people you mentioned, including yourself, I regard as you know, the sort of sane, rational people that I can appeal to.
Actually, I gave a brief obituary to Dan on this podcast, but and I think I said this, but I will remind you if you haven't heard it. In some of these exchanges, it was adorable to see how Dan was the voice of restraint. And he was often restraining the two of us in our
yes.
temptation to just hurl fire and brimstone at somebody
yes.
in public. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a fun dynamic. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, Richard, it's wonderful to speak with you yet again. I wish you the best of luck on your what sounds like it's an interminable book tour. That's a long one.
Yes, it's a long one. Yeah. Thank you very much, Sam. It's been always, as you say, it's always the greatest of pleasures. Thank you so much.